Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and we are very excited for today's guest coming to the show for the first time. You may know him from such books as Joyride, Nightwing, Red Robin, and currently the artist on Excalibur with Teeny Howard. It is the one and only Marcus Anthony Toe. Welcome to the show, Marcus. Thank you for doing this with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Eric. I appreciate you taking the time, you know, to talk comics with me.
Absolutely. I've been meaning to have you on for a while, so it's nice that our schedules were able to line up. How has your 2020 been, this crazy year that is 2020?
Well, you know what? In all honesty, I can't complain. I've been really lucky, incredibly lucky. You know, I'm safe, happy, healthy. You know, as with everyone, we're a little bit stressed out with the goings on of today's, the stuff going on in everywhere, all around the world. And but it's important to acknowledge that too. But also know that, you know, we're very blessed to be. We were just talking about, you know, living where we live in Toronto, and it's. We're doing pretty good. We're doing pretty good, I'd have to say.
Yeah, it's true. You know, it could have been a lot more frustrating when you look at how some other places not too far from us are doing. So, yeah, definitely yeah. Grateful for living in our city and all in all our country. We're doing pretty good. So it's hopeful. Fingers crossed that we'll be more back to normal in our city in the next couple of months.
Well, let's hope to even be better than that, right? Because we all got our problems, and we all got right now it's been good to see all the issues right now, because, you know, we're so involved on being online because we can't see everybody.
Yeah.
Right. And we're all trying to do better than the last time. So let's fingers crossed that we can get to that point too, right?
Absolutely. You're right. I mean, the advance of technology that we can still communicate and see each other is really nice, but there's nothing like being able to hug your friend. Like, there's something to that that is very valuable. So this should teach us.
I'm too scared to even put a handshake, you know, like give someone a handshake.
Right? Sometimes I watch some of the movies that are like just so normal, and then you see like, oh my god, they shook hands, like you're not supposed to do that. So we'll see what the new greeting is going to, maybe we're going to be like Japan where we'll bow to each other and show proper respect, but it is nice to give your friends a hug. I miss that.
yeah same here.
So let's take it back to the beginning. You are from Red Deer, Alberta, in between Calgary and Edmonton. So I got to ask you, who did you cheer for as a kid watching hockey? Because I know you're a hockey fan.
Yeah, quite a hockey fan. You know, my life as a sports fan is very weird, because, I mean, you know, you live in a small town, you cheer for the local team, which is the Rebels, which was great. You know, we had the chance to go to some of those games when I was a kid, which was awesome. But I also went to a French Catholic school, so a lot of the friends were, you know, Montreal Canadiens fans, Quebec Nordiques fans. All my friends had all different teams, you know, everything from the Penguins to the Kings to the Oilers and the Flames. And, you know, as a kid, I was a Kings fan because of Gretzky. But as I got older, it went to Vancouver.
Oh, did you?
And I've been up. I've been incredibly sad ever since.
Well, you know what? At least you've seen in your lifetime Vancouver make it to the Stanley Cup playoffs, because I haven't seen the Leafs do that. So at least you've been able to have that close call. When they made it against the last time, against Chicago, did they go to a game 7? Or was it a game 6?
Well, the... In 2011?
Yeah, yeah.
So in 2011, they beat the Blackhawks in game 7 in the first round, which was insane, because that first round was just... Because the Canucks were up, I think it was 3-0, or 3-1, and then and then the Blackhawks came back, and then they won it in overtime in game 7.
That's right.
Which, that was the most exciting thing I've ever seen in my life, but... You know,
I was thinking of Boston.
Alas, it didn't turn out well.
Yeah. But I mean, that's the thing, right? I don't remember the last time the Leafs made it to the second round of the playoffs. So you're better off cheering for Vancouver.
Well, how old are you, actually, if you don't mind me asking?
I think we are the same age. I'm 36.
Because I remember early 90s Leafs were pretty potent.
They were good, but they were stopped by Gretzky.
So, 94 game against the Canucks.
Yes, that's the one. That's the one where the Canucks went to the finals.
And well, 93 against Gretzky.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then it's same thing the next year after, where it's 94 Canucks beat the Leafs to go to the finals as well. Those were the 2 years that they had the best chance to win it all.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, those two finals that they didn't make it to were such great playoff years for hockey in general, like seeing the Rangers win and even watching like the Canadians do that overtime playoff run that they did. It would have been amazing though to see original six teams in both of those finals, which is like but it was still good.
Sure.
Yeah. So what was it like growing up in Red Deer? Tell me more.
And
about
they said that you know, there's a lot that felt like it. Oh, Red Deer. Well, it was, you know, pretty standard small Canadian town, I would say. I think that, you know, a lot of outdoor activities. I played a lot of baseball. I played a lot of outdoor hockey, whether it be, you know, street hockey or outdoor rinks. And I grew a lot. My first love was sports, and I wanted to be a hockey player. I wanted to be a baseball player, but my parents didn't really know, because my parents were immigrants. They didn't really know what to do. Put me into organized sports. That wasn't a thing. They didn't know what to do. So, you know, and I feel like that's generally a pretty standard, you know, small town Canada type of, you know, childhood, because we're pretty lucky to have the space that we have. And like I said, I played a lot of baseball because those early Blue Jays years, you know, all across Canada, that there was a huge influx of interest in baseball. And ever since then, I just love playing baseball.
Yeah. I apologize for the lag. I might be interrupting you and I don't mean to. So what I'm going to do is shut off the video on my end. And if you want to do the same, that's up to you.
Yeah, no problem.
Just so I don't interrupt you, because I don't know sometimes with the Wi-Fi what will happen. It's more important that I hear you, though. Baseball.
Yeah, for sure.
You're saying that was a great time. I mean, I just on my last podcast, I was talking to David Harper, who does the Off-Panel podcast, and we were talking about the Joe Carter home run. Like, there's no sports memory. And like that moment of adulation that tops that moment that I've seen in my life. The Blue Jays in the last couple years came pretty close with those walk-off moments, but to win the whole championship. And of course, the Kawhi shot last year was pretty incredible. But it's nice to have those things in Toronto, because they're few and far between sometimes. So when you have those moments, they are definitely special.
But isn't that, like, that's the interesting thing about talking about kind of those moments. And I don't know, I like to bring it back to you as well, you know, comic books, because I think about comics in a lot of different ways, from the kind of superhero stuff that we normally love, and the stories, the drama that you have. I've always felt that sports drama is the truest drama, because it's so real. Like, you can't guess what's going to happen. You can assume, you can make your best guesses, but, you know, all those events that we just talked about, you know, it's true drama, and that's, you know, you look at all the fiction that we like to consume as well. You know, we're craving that drama, those superhero moments, and those times where you can be that hero, and sports gives us that too, you know?
Yeah, I don't know, absolutely. It's 'cause it's all of these things that have to be working all at once, that is so chaotic, and then at the same time so amazingly organized. Like, when you see an athlete perform some sort of feat that can make, you know, grown people, men, women, act as children. Like, there's something so special about that that can't be duplicated. And when, you know, you really feel it when it's not around. Like, there's something definitely necessary, I learned during this pandemic, of what sports does. It brings people together. It brings cities together. And we share a memory, a story. Like, last year with the Raptors, just what the way the city felt, the buzz. Even if you weren't into basketball, there was something special about that joint experience. And when it's taken out, like the way it is now, it's like, man, those things are really important. It is valuable.
Yeah, I mean, just exactly like you said, you know, like a lot of aspects that where you consider yourself or consider luxury items. And again, we talk about movies and comic books and sports and all these things. You realize how important they are in society to kind of, just like you said, where you share the drama together with others, and a shared experience with the community is always like so important. And it's interesting seeing it, like you said, where we don't have that. And for a while with comics, where comics was on pause for a good while too, and you couldn't get those, you know, things. And it just shows you how important they are to the fabric of, you know, our lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even those little rituals we have when it comes to comics or movies of meeting up with a friend and going to the movies or going to the comic shop. Like, half the time I went to the comic shop, I didn't really need anything. I went there more for being able to talk to people and maybe be inspired to read something new. It was that little community that you develop, which is, it's nice. It's nice to belong to. And when that's taken away, it's like, man, I miss the comic shop.
Yeah, and cons too, right? We won't have conventions for a good while, so.
Absolutely. Do you miss the cons?
Yes and no.
Yeah, because you have to work on.
Yeah, well, the best part of it, as you said, you know, you meet up with friends that you haven't seen in a long time because, you know, everyone travels. But you get a chance to meet a lot of fans that are passionate about the things that you do. And to share that passion with other people is why I like cons.
Yeah.
The working part is really tough and, you know, like, there's a lot of stress involved.
Yeah.
But again, like you said, I really embrace sharing those kind of moments with people because, I mean, that's why I like sports. That's why I like doing these things. I like to, you know, share in the passion because that helps fuel my own, especially when I'm working at home by myself, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It was something that, you know, in talking to a lot of artists during this time, you guys are specifically almost bred for being able to work by yourself and not having to worry about what's happening in the outside world. It's almost like a good discipline to have. But when now you're like that, it's not even an option to be able to go to the coffee shop and maybe get a little inspiration by people watching or stuff like that. It does wear on you even when this is kind of what you guys do. So yeah, the con and being able to interact with the fans and get their feedback and it does give you that extra oomph you need to keep going. So I totally get it. What made you fall in love with comics? What was that thing, that moment, if you can remember it?
I don't know if there was one specific moment. I would say that, you know, for a long, long time, as a kid, my mom taught me how to draw, and it was mostly to keep me out of trouble. But, you know, I continued to draw, and you know, as I got older, you start to see, you know, cartoons that interested you. And in the early 90s, there was a lot of, you know, comics cartoons that started coming out, like the Spider-Man cartoon and the X-Men cartoon, Ghostbusters, Ninja Turtles, all those kind of things that revolved around comics and that kind of, you know, field. And a lot of it became that I wanted to know and read more stories about those characters. Now, you had Spider-Man, you had X-Men and Ninja Turtles, and you had the stories within the episode. But sometimes when you're so interested in something, you just want more of it, right? You want to read more stories about these characters that you love. Even if they're slightly different, you just want to know what what goes on in their lives. And that brought me into comics, because, you know, you saw the characters that you really, really liked on screen, mm-hmm. and they even looked better in comics, which is amazing. And then, so, you know, I started picking them up a little bit here and there, but it wasn't really until I was, in my later teens when I had a job that I could actually afford to buy comics and, you know, read them regularly.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a similar experience. I loved comic books and superheroes as a kid, but again, it wasn't until I had a full-time job where I could, go to the store on my own and buy mm-hmm. whatever it was that I could afford at the time and keep up with something. But there's a certain, I'm not sure what it is between people who love comics, but there's a certain language that we can understand when we look at the page and an experience that we appreciate, that it, there's something special to that. So I think, yeah, I could totally relate to that being a little older and having to catch up on it. Like, I'm a huge X-Men fan myself, but I didn't grow up on X-Men because, you know, there's that limited resource. So I had, you know, Superman comics. That's what I could afford. But now catching up on it, even that 90s stuff that gets, you know, often criticized, there's a lot of good stuff there. Great artwork. And even some of the stories, man. Yep. That's, I think, the strong part of 90s comics. With all the, you know, stuff that was going on that people criticized, that stuff was still good, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, like, you know, here's the thing about good and bad, and I always think about art in this way, because we're so quick to judge on what's good and what's bad, and
yeah,
and it's really hard to judge that, because how you experience art is sometimes a very individual moment. So lots of things can happen when you read a certain story. You could be in the right frame of mind to be receptive of those stories, or you could have been, you know, like, you know, you could have been, I don't know, maybe you broke up with your girlfriend or boyfriend and you read a story that's like, wow, you know, that explains exactly how I feel right now.
Yeah.
But if someone says that, no, that story sucks, and you're like, how can you tell that person that? What? Because their experience with that is more of a personal one. So they would find it good because it means something to them, while maybe for somebody else it doesn't. So I'm always open to listening to, like, different points of view with good or bad. It's a fine line to skate, though, because I mean, it's very easy to get into an argument because people are passionate about this and people are passionate about their stories, and I do understand that.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, even sometimes the circumstances of the weather or the format that you read the book, like if you read it in a hardcover, it was for some reason you appreciated it more than when you read it on digital. Like, all of these different factors affect the way we consume art. So it's true. Like, you can't not, there isn't, there is no, it's so subjective. Like, absolutely.
And I think that you should embrace that kind of, you know, thinking while assessing, you know, story, because that has a factor to play in enjoyment of it. It's not just straight facts of,
yeah,
this is, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, not always the case, right?
Right, exactly. You talked about the influence of your mother, and I've heard you mention her before of how important a role mm-hmm. she played in your life, just as pursuing your passion in some of the work you've done. Tell me more about that.
Well, you know, she's, I don't know if I would say she's typical Asian mother, but, you know, she is, you know, she immigrated here when she was in her teens, and, you know, I think she always really liked art, but it never occurred to her that it was possible to make money off of it, which is, you know, you hear that story with a lot of immigrant families, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, growing up, it wasn't necessarily that she encouraged my drawing, but she also didn't discourage it. You know, she taught me how to draw so that I was able to sit still. You know, like, we had a, we owned a family restaurant, and a lot of the time spent was just in the office in the back, or if it's not busy, we'd be sitting at a table out front and you'd have nothing to do. And so you'd just draw. My brother and I would draw on the placemats, and, you know, just as I got older, it was interesting because, you know, she did push me, but she never pushed me in any particular direction. So she would just kind of like almost allow me to figure my own way out in this situation. But yeah, it's hard to kind of pinpoint how, you know, what kind of person she is in my life, because it feels like when you say these things, they're so simple. Like there's no, there was never any grand gesture or huge moment that changed my life. It was just a progression of how she treated me and handled me growing up to, and never really, I was never particularly good in school, and she was never that hard on me to be good like that. You know, whenever I got in trouble for stuff in school, she wouldn't, you know, not excuse what I did, but she'd always explain to me why it was the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, she's an interesting woman. She's very traditional, but also not in a lot of ways. Like she just very hands-on, but whatever you want to do, like, you right. know, she'll go with how she'll almost listen to how you want to do things and just go with it. Unless if you had kids, like if I had kids, she would not allow me to. She has her own ways of doing things. But other than that, yeah, I think it's just the general support that I've always felt that I had with her, even though she never had to really say anything.
Yeah, that's huge, though. That's huge. You're right. To think of that grand moment might be hard to come by with a parent, but it's more of the accumulation of a life that you realize, like, this was a stability, this was a consistent thing that was there, and that's the real grand gesture.
Oh, for sure. And you know what? I realized as I've gotten older that that can be quite rare in a lot of cases. I know people in my life that don't have that part. And you know, the funny thing about, I was talking to my brother about this during this pandemic. So I live here in Toronto, and my parents and basically my whole family lives in Vancouver. And it's times like these that I really do miss them. And I realize, you know, I can't see them easily. In fact, I may not see them for another year or plus, maybe, you know, depending on how comfortable I am with flying. And yeah, it's moments like that where you kind of think about how lucky I was having that, like you said, the stability to just do the things that I want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So what was the driving force for you to want to get into comics as an artist? When did you say this is something I want to be doing for myself?
So I always have a joke about this question because I always say that I chose comics as I couldn't do math. And that's true to a certain degree. Like math, so when I was I always liked comics, and I started doing my own comics at a young age, like, you know, 13, 14. I started just drawing my own comics. You know, I would look at the comics that I bought, and I think to myself, like, how do I do exactly this thing? Because that, I think for me, my personality was always like looking at something, I think it was neat, and seeing if I can replicate it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to take novels and then draw out the scene of just whatever random scene that I would pick out of a novel, and just to, you know, see if I could draw it with pictures.
Right.
So that was good practice right away. And when I got into college, I decided to go into animation because in the early 2000s, that was kind of like everyone was trying to go into video games. Not that they're not now, but I mean, that was, you know, the beginning of that boom of, you know, you had StarCraft 2 come out, just StarCraft 1 coming out, that came out just a couple of years before that, and it was huge. You know, you had World of Warcraft coming up at that time. You know, companies were putting money into this stuff, so I went into college for that, but it really turned out really well. Like, I mean, I learned a lot when I went to the 3D animation. You know, you did a lot of storyboards, you did a lot of life drawing, a lot of everything, setting up scenes and texture building and model building and all that stuff in a 3D plane. It kind of brought me back to thinking about, you know, doing comics, because I learned all these things that actually helped me think about comics in a different way, you know, like making comics, and what I can do to get better at it. So, I continued on drawing, you know, my own stories, and that's actually where the idea of Joyride came about. Ah. Was around that time. And then after that, when I couldn't get a work in the industry because I just wasn't good enough of a 3D animator, I tried to do computer science, and can you hear me?
Yeah, still? I can hear you. Yep.
Okay. And so, yeah, so then I went into computer science and didn't really go well for me. I ended up failing out of it in the first year. And then that really put things into perspective of what I really wanted to do with my life, because I tried a bunch of different things that I thought I can maybe game the system because, you know, oh, games is, you can make more money in it.
Right.
And computer science, I could do something more with that, and I couldn't do any of it because my interest level was not there. And the thing I'm most interested in was always drawing comics. So I, from that point, I decided to, just try to break in. I just wanted to build a portfolio first and foremost, start hitting up shows and see how far I can go. And to be honest with you, that's still the same mentality I have now. Is the let's try something and just see how far it goes.
I think that's incredible, though, because you did all of the things of, you know, you took the post-secondary education, you tried to do things that perhaps you were interested in or where you saw, you know, there's job opportunities here perhaps in the future. And you didn't quit at anything because you didn't excel at it. Maybe you quit at the things you didn't excel at, but you said, I'm not going to quit. I'm going to do what I love to do. And I think that's such a valuable lesson, because a lot of times we feel there's certain paths we're supposed to take and be at certain places in our life. And the fact that you said, this is what I like doing and this is what I'm going to pursue. And it worked out pretty well for you thus far. I mean, you're on
so far.
I mean, you keep getting better and better, and it's showing in the work, right? So when you built this portfolio, what were some of the steps like, as regards to the networking and things that maybe your experience can be something that somebody who also has those dreams, what were some of the things that you did? Because you have what sounds like a good work ethic.
Well, one of the things I like to always point out, and sometimes I get into trouble saying this from other artists, but you know how sometimes they say that you got to, you know, draw what you love and all this stuff. And while that's all good and all, not all of us are super talented enough that I can just look at something and draw it. I have to like figure it out. I have to break it down and then look at it a billion times over and then copy it before my brain will put two and two together to make it make sense. And once it makes sense, it's there. But we all learn differently, right?
Right.
So I've always felt that I would give myself tasks to do whether I like it or not. Mm-hmm. Just to see if I could do it. And then from there, you know, you learn from failing. So what I did back then was I would take some stories that I felt like I really wanted to tell, or I'd take snippets of a book and then try to draw them. So my portfolio revolved around kind of different things. I was kind of into zombie movies at the time. Mm-hmm. I drew like a short zombie story so I could practice pasting. You know, mm-hmm. A horror story doesn't need words. That's the beauty of that. Not like a lot of stories don't need words, but horror story, you can really play with the visual aspect of comics, mm-hmm. because there's the pacing, the page turn, all those things that you can draw in the reader with just snippets of images to, you know, string them along the story until there's a reveal at the end of whatever you're trying to do, right? Mm-hmm. And I found that as a good way to practice the pacing. Also, you know, I was dating a girl at the time who the relationship didn't go well. Mm-hmm. And so I drew a little short story revolving on that, which is only like 4 pages. But it also that helped me draw regular people, you know, like
right.
normal, everyday, regular people, regular story.
Right.
And then I also threw in like a Ninja Turtle story where, you know, Raphael stops a bad guy from robbing a 7-Eleven. A Spider-Man story where he stops Doc Ock from robbing a bank and he has some hostages. And, you know, a Superman story where he fights Solomon Grundy. And, like, that was my portfolio, and I tried to stick with that type of thing where you have a couple superhero stuff where everyone knows so they can see how you draw their characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of stories of stuff that is not superhero at all, you know, whether it be real life things or supernatural things, but on a, you know, like on more of a fantasy level perhaps, or, and I would, you know, litter my portfolio with that. And I would take that portfolio with all those pieces and then show, people at conventions, and in every new convention I'd try to have at the very least a new short story drawn so people can see consistency from seeing you at a show, but also seeing your work over and over and over a longer period of time to see you progress, but also to show that you have the work ethic. Because in a lot of ways, when you're looking to get work in comics, they need you to complete tasks on time, and that is a difficulty for an up-and-coming creator in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I remember attending a panel that you did with, I think it was Michael Cho, and it was called mm-hmm. A Page a Day, and you really mm-hmm. stressed the fact of keeping a discipline for yourself because of that deadline aspect of the business, where if you are consistent and you pace yourself in a way where you're productive, the work will get better, but also mm-hmm. you'll be hireable. So I thought, you know, that it impressed upon me that recognition of the work ethic involved in something that it does involve inspiration, right? You need to feel inspired. Mm-hmm. You need to feel like everything is kind of working the way you need it to, but also there has to be a level of consistency. I like those things that you described of the different types of short stories you did, because they all had characters, even the ones that were just, you know, day in the life sort of thing, but the Spider-Man, the Superman, the Raphael, all these different characters with different power sets and rules that you have to kind of work with and manipulate. So I guess that in itself is a good, yep. like you said, challenging yourself to work in different spaces that keep these characters either tethered or free them to do certain things, and showing those skills. And you kind of see it in Joyride, all the different places that you end up there. Tell me a little bit about Joyride, because you said that you had that idea for it years before it came to fruition, and then you collaborated with two other writers on it. So I wasn't sure how much of the story was mm-hmm. from the three of you. Can you tell me a little about the creation of Joyride?
Well, it's interesting because so Joyride kind of came about, like I said, when I was in high school, and I was just drawing things, stories to part practice. Maybe I was bored, but in these stories, and really, it started out really basic. You know, it's kind of a, you know, the world is under a dictator,
mm-hmm.
and he kind of walled up the entire earth so that he can control the earth, and then these group of, you know, steal a spaceship and leave earth to find a better life. You know, this, it's kind of like that immigrant story, hero's journey, all those things that, you know, are very simple things that everyone can relate to.
Right.
And, but I didn't think about it at that time. You know, I was just a fan of Star Wars, you know, in high school, and, you know, old Jet Li, Jackie Chan movies, Journey to the West kind of thing. All those stories that I grew up on. So I just kind of decided, you know, like I've loved all these stories. Why not try to make my own, right? So from that point, I did 3 issues, and then I got into comics, and I just never touched it again for, I don't know, 10 years. And And then I met Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly after we did, or after I did Cyborg 009, and we were moving on to Hacktivist with Alyssa Milano.
Hmm.
And we worked so well together in a weird, really, really weird way. So Jackson and Colin are like a writing team, which is already kind of, you don't see that very often.
Mm-hmm.
Two guys that usually, not always, usually work together on projects because, and they're like a hive mind. It's really interesting hearing, seeing them, and you can see it in their scripts where it's quite verbose, but in the way I like, because it that gives me a lot of information, but I get to choose what goes in. So they both like to explain a lot of things, but they give me the freedom to choose how it's all put together. So from those points, I thought to myself, especially when after it, all those things went well and Boom where it was interested in us as a team, they asked us if we wanted to, you know, do something together. And I said, well, you know, like if you were interested, I have this idea that I've been sitting on since high school. Why don't I just talk about it? So we just kind of started talking, and the thing that they really got caught up on was Earth sucks, let's steal a spaceship. So that the story kind of revolved around that theme of you know, teenage rebellion, but in general there's more to it than just, you know, the typical. We wanted things to be we always wanted it to be something like, you know, when you first moved out of your parents' house and mm-hmm. you were so excited for all the fun things you were going to do, but then you realized, oh, crap, some of the money has to go to buying toilet paper, and some of the money has to go into, like, and you realize all the responsibility that you have to deal with now that you're out on your own. And
right.
I think part of Joyride was wanting to get those themes across of both freedom but responsibility, you know? And I think I'm really excited about, I've always been really excited about Joyride. I've always felt like if we could have gone on with it forever, we would have. And, a lot of it comes from our love for, you know, sci-fi, Star Trek, Farscape, all those stories, that revolved around the classic sci-fi, of commenting on social issues, but in a fantastical way.
Right, right. Because as I was reading it, I had read the first trade a few years ago, mm-hmm. and then I read all 12 issues recently, and they did mm-hmm. feel, obviously, comic books are, you know, serialized and episodic in nature, but each issue mm-hmm. kind of felt more of episodes as opposed to a direct to be continued in the last issue, this and this happened. A lot of times you find yourself like, oh, they're on the run from something. Did I miss something? But it was very much like a Teen Titans mixed with a Star Wars sci-fi aspect to it, as well as that Star Trek element. I don't know if that's a fair assessment, because you have those young people kind of figuring things out and learning to deal with new relationships, and also relationships that don't work out the way they expect it to, but then at the same time, getting themselves out of problems while learning new things about their surroundings.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, I think that, you know, whenever I write a story, I try to think about these themes and what I want to tell the audience. I never really want to tell a story that doesn't have that, because it just feels a little hollow then, at least.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad it comes across, and I feel like the thing with creating with, a team is that you kind of have to have the same morals, I guess, if you want to say, or at least you want to say the same thing.
Right.
And making sure that your story has a message is I think the most important thing. Why do we love the things we love? Because they say something to us specifically. It's almost like that story is us mm-hmm. in that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we want to create it. We want to put the reader in to understand, you know, why the characters did the things that they did, and then why, you know, they maybe you know, feel a certain way, and also kind of, that's why, you know, when people talk about representation, you know, it does matter. And is the story revolves a lot around, you know, sexual orientation and race. But if you break it all down, we all want that. We all want to feel like we can relate to the character that's in there, right? It's, and I feel like that should be the basis of all stories. But there's money involved too, so I mean, I do understand, you know, if you talk about Hollywood and all this stuff, that money talks. If you know, if 2 + 2 = $1 million, and then 2 + 3 = $2 million, you would go where whatever 2 + 3 is. So it's such a weird business to be in.
Right. Well, the thing that I appreciated about your story in particular is, one, because it's creator-owned, you're telling the story that you want to tell, and you're not, it doesn't feel like anything is being done to cater to audiences or to not cater to audiences. And because of that, it's like the representation isn't forced, it's just natural, which is, I think, the best way for these kind of stories to be told. Because sometimes you, with I think more so with the bigger companies, the corporate companies, people have more of that argument of they're kind of forcing something because they want to cater to an audience and not get blowback. But when you have creator-owned stuff, this is, I think, oftentimes the best way to tell these stories because they're fresh. When you try to change, you know, 70 years worth of how Captain America or some character has been perceived, it's going to, I don't think, be as effective as a Joyride will be, because one, it's good for all ages to read, and two, it hits all of these things without it ever feeling like, okay, that's checked off the list, that's checked off the list. So the reaction you get while you're reading it is organic, and you do come away with that feeling of breaking out of the bubble, because there's that symbolism in the book of breaking out of Earth, which has been given this protective bubble to protect our minds and what we, you know, be scared of the woods. Don't go out there, because if you go out there, everything bad will happen. And when you realize, you know, you can exist. Things will be tricky. Things will be scary, but it's not necessarily death. Or it could be.
Yeah.
It all depends on what you do. Yeah.
I think one of the things that I wanted to do that unfortunately didn't have time was, you know, because I figured it's the future. There'd be a lot of mixed races and mixed people of different backgrounds. But I mean, we didn't really spend a lot of time on Earth.
Right.
And there's no need to talk about where their ancestry comes from.
Right.
So it never really kind of got to that point. I wanted to, but I mean, like you said, I tried to, we're looking at stories and how to kind of build it, and it didn't fit in some of the stories to go along with. We had like a lot of stories planned, but you know, that's another hard thing about having a creator owned, that you don't have necessarily the luxury of having the money to produce it as far as you might want to. We actually had a ton of different stories. We wanted to have, like, one of the stories we never got told, which I wanted to do, but we couldn't fit it in, was, well, I wanted like a Breakfast Club kind of episode where they get stuck in jail somehow, and then you have those Breakfast Club moments.
That would be great. Yeah.
It's like those X-Men moments. Wanted to do like that one of the episodes that we kind of did, but it's very, it wasn't overtly Scooby-Doo, but the episode where they find Bot, in the evil Bot in the ship.
Right.
And how they kind of figure out the ship. That one was a little bit, we were thinking about, like, you know, how Scooby and the gang would handle it. They're like those kind of things we utilized to throw into our inspirations to write a story. Like, it could be a sci-fi story, but because, you know, we're fans of so many things, their style of telling a story and telling a reveal,
right,
you can utilize in different ways of, in different stories, to kind of make it more robust, right? It's not just as straightforward as a horror story or a sci-fi story. You can have a lot of these nuances and subgenres that to really play with each individual story, which is why we wanted it to be episodic.
Right.
So we had that ability to play, because, and it made sense, because since we're in space, you know, they would go from planet to planet, and it could be a different thing all the time.
Right.
Right.
Is there any plan to bring it back in the future if it's feasible?
There's always some thoughts on it, and you know, there are some, there might be some good news on horizon, but that's still far from, you know, anything concrete yet. So let's just, you know, say it as that. But okay. I even thought about just talking to Jackson and Colin and just doing it ourselves.
Right. Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
So that's always a possibility, but right now I'm not thinking about that.
Right.
Right now I have like you know, some other personal stories that I'm planning to go through Raid Studios, which is the studio that I'm part of.
Yes, tell me about that.
Publishing it from there. Yeah.
What's the experience like working at Raid? We have some mutual friends who are there. I always hear great things about it, but how did you end up at Raid? And I was told to talk about the storefront that you guys are setting up there. So please don't feel free to talk about that.
Sure. Well, I got into Raid about a year after I moved to Toronto, and one of the main reasons why I moved from Alberta to Toronto was because I was looking for, you know, as an artist in Alberta, I felt like I was missing something. And it doesn't necessarily mean artists, like being around other artists, but I felt like I wasn't learning anything new. You know, I'm just working at home by myself, and I didn't have, people can talk about inspiration and that could be a way to describe it. But, you know, my friend Francis Manipal, he convinced me to try Toronto out, and it felt exactly right. And then, so after moving to Toronto, I took the next step to join Raid Studios, which I was invited by Kalman Andrzejowski. And it was tough going at first. I wasn't comfortable with working around people, and especially I didn't know them very well. In fact, it took me about a year to go there regularly. So I was paying rent to go there maybe once a week, once every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But I started feeling more and more comfortable, and then from there it just blossomed. I felt like I was learning so much from being around peers, other people that have done things before, and do things differently. So I would learn different techniques. I would learn to use different programs. Like I would have never learned to, well, maybe not never, but I mean, they inspired me to try my hand at digital, drawing digitally. And I feel like I've blossomed just being, able to do the things that I can do on digital. And, on top of that too, even from the small things like, you know, doing my taxes, like we share a lot of the information that, you know, in a lot of ways when you work by yourself, you have to figure that out on your own.
Right.
Yeah. Which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but no. It does flow a little bit more organically when, you know, you see other people that, you know, you learn from others. And I think that, you know, that's the great thing about the community in Toronto is that you have the ability to learn from so many great creators all around the city. Why not take advantage of that? And if we go to the storefront, that's what we're planning to do, and hopefully we can give that to others as well. Like one of the main things about the studio that I want out of it is I want to give others the same opportunities that I got.
Right.
So if we open the storefront and start hosting events, say, and this is still a ways off because of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
We can't have, you know, gatherings like that anymore, but yet. So hopefully soon, you know, a lot of things that we want to do will be there. We want to have events, to gallery events for up and coming artists, so they can have their work showcased.
That's great.
You know, book signing events from young indie creators that need a space to kind of, you know, put their books out to show the world. And you know, we want to give those opportunities that we got, and we have the opportunity as a group to help. And I think that's what the main goal is. You know, with COVID and everything, that's kind of, you know, we've been slowed down on a lot of that, but that's not always the worst thing either. It might give us a chance to, you know, group like make a better presentation for it and really finalize all the things we want to do, you know, like we, you know, to understand what the community needs from us and what the community wants from us and what we can do to help.
Yeah, that's great. I can't wait for that to happen because one, I'll be down there often if that's the, if it's a storefront. And it's great for the community to have that sort of connection to the creators because there are so many people here. There are so many good creators as well working at Raid doing a bunch of different types of projects. And to be able to have that sort of thing, to be able to visit and have those events mid-year, that'll be great because we're a thriving comic book community. We have so many different shows, but then to have a spot like that, that'll be great. I can't wait for that. I've been told.
Yeah, fingers crossed that it all goes over well.
It will, for sure. We got to be positive and just put it out there, and it'll happen. I've been told by people that I got to choose my words carefully now. I was going to say mentoring. That's not the right word. Sure. you're helping fellow artists. The same help that you said you received. Mm-hmm. You have a reputation for being so generous and helping other people. Is that because of you wanting to pay it forward, or is it like where does that come from for you to want to be able to share whatever you've learned with others?
Well, it's interesting because there's so many things you can learn on your own and do your own thing, but when it came to being a professional, being a well-rounded pro, whether it comes to just drawing, not just writing, it's about everything. We help each other with how to write emails to editors, how to price yourself when someone asks for a quote. You know, how to, again, like I said, how to do your taxes, how to organize yourself so that you maximize what you make. Right?
Mm-hmm.
All these things I would have never even thought of. And we're doing it together,
right.
You know, all the small things that, and again, this is like, you go into comics thinking like, oh man, I'm going to draw comics. Then next thing you know that's like the easiest part of the job. You have to, you know, you have to mingle with creators and editors to get more work, right? You gotta talk to, you know, production managers so that you can get paid for, you know, like storyboards, or you got to do all these things that generally you're not taught.
Right, right.
Right. And I think that it's been so good just to learn how to, and those are the same parts that I'm missing.
Right.
Right. In my repertoire. But maybe say if you joined the studio, you'd have other parts that aren't maybe up to snuff, but you were good at other things. So us as a group, the ones that are good at one thing can help the others that aren't, and then vice versa, right?
Right.
And from just that experience, and I feel like we have the opportunity for those that want it, you know, like not everyone wants that, that if we have the opportunity, we should use it properly, right?
Right. No, absolutely.
And I know it's been, you know, like I know there's a lot of, you know, there's just like every community, there's a lot of positives and negatives. And I know that a lot of the negatives in the comic book community revolve around, you know, basically a very selfish sense of self-worth
mm-hmm.
for a lot of pro comic creators.
Right.
And I think that that's also something I would personally like to try to change,
right.
You know, like to make sure that we as a community, especially as professionals, we do help other people with no strings attached. You know,
right.
we just want other creators to thrive because if they thrive, we thrive.
Yeah.
Right?
That's the right attitude to have. I mean, I work in an industry where there's, you know, apprentices, literally apprentices that you've got to work with and bring up, and you want the people who you help to be not just good, but better after you've been, you know, help them. You want them to be a better version of whatever you had. Like, that's the proper attitude to have, because it'll make the art form, the industry, the community keep going, keep getting better. So when we kind of, when competition is good, it's important to be inspired by others so that you have that drive. Like, I want to do that now. They did that. I want to write that story. I want to draw that page. But at the same time, we also, we got to lift each other up. Like, that's the only way that this is going to be something special. So that's a great attitude that, that you have and that you're sharing with people. I would be remiss to not talk about Excalibur. We've been going 55 minutes. I don't know what, how you're doing for time. I don't want to take too much of it, but we have to talk a little bit about working in the X family now. How did that all come together?
Yeah, no, not a problem at all.
Okay. Because Hickman...
Well, it's funny because... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say Hickman has done this X-Men revolution where the world is watching again, it seems, right? For everyone loves the X-Men a lot of time, but it has... didn't have quite an identity for a little bit. Like, you didn't know exactly what the book was anymore, and people did good things. You can't take away from good stories told, but when Hickman came, like, that Power of 10, House of X stuff kind of, it reignited this X-Men machine. So how did that come together for you?
Well, I mean, as an artist, especially nowadays, we are generally not in the know until, like, we're the one of the last ones hired for these things. So I honestly don't know beyond some things.
Okay.
But I always bring it back to kind of my career as a whole is kind of a really interesting one, I think. And I jump around a lot, obviously, and you know, from company to company, because there's always different opportunities. There's, you meet different editors and they have different ideas, and then you could you know, work on different things like that. And I my first run with Marvel was on New Warriors with Chris Yost writing it, which I knew from Red Robin, obviously. And ever since then, there was very little work from Marvel for a while. And I actually for a while didn't even think that I would, you know, get much Marvel work. And it wasn't until, I want to say, Ricky Purdon got hired as talent manager. And he was always a very big support of my work because... And not necessarily because I was good or anything. And I'm not trying to downplay my quality or anything like that. But part of this is because, you know, like, I helped them out of a jam when it came to a deadline that was really needed to be done. And ever since then, also we worked together on Red Robin for a brief period as well. Like, me and Ricky, when he was an editor at DC, we worked on that. So he's always been looking out for me in a way because, you know, like, I helped alleviate a problem that, you know, happened at DC. And then so he kind of just, you know, would try to give me work here and there, for, you know, one shots or a couple short stories, you know, which is great. I always really appreciate someone always thinking about my work. But, and then all of a sudden he asked if I wanted to be a part of, X-Men Blue to do fill-ins for X-Men Blue. And ever since then, they liked my work in the X office. And then obviously that went on to next gen stuff. And then when the relaunch of the X-Men came about, then I was lucky enough that they liked my work enough and they wanted to bring me on such a big project. And I feel like, you know, when it comes to professional work, I try to always do those things that this might not always be the project of my dreams. Not to say X-Men Blue wasn't a great experience, but they were fill-ins, right? They only needed one or two issues done. Just try to do as good and as professional as you can and stay on deadline.
Right.
That eventually, you know, they see your worth and put you on something that you think that they could do it. And, you know, Excalibur's was great. I don't think I've ever been on a book that had this much hype to it.
Right.
So it's been amazing. And I would love to, I would have loved to have been a part of the decision making with Jonathan Hickman and all those kind of things, but that's not the role of an artist anymore, usually, right?
Right. So in regards to the, because it seems as though, I mean, there's all these individual writers and teams working on different books.
Yeah.
Does he have an overall vision of where these books have to go? And is it affecting the storytelling that you are able to do based on the direction that he wants this whole universe to go for you and Teenie Howard?
Well, I that part I'm not 100% sure. What I do know is that he apparently wrote like a Bible for his view of vision of the X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a general ship, using an analogy, that is the story and where the general kind of, you know, direction that the X books will go. And then there's the wake, and then, you know, you have to just work within that wake.
Okay.
So there's some freedom to do what you want to, mm-hmm. but there's rules that are, you know, the rules of the world, like you were saying, that, you know, were set in motion.
Yeah. Were you a fan of Excalibur growing up? Like, how, if you were, how does the team, the traditional team that was Excalibur, and the one that the characters you get to work with, because it's very much a 90s X-Men team in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wasn't exactly a fan of Excalibur. Again, like I was saying, a lot of my comic reading life is kind of limited in some ways, just from not having the money to buy anything, so I would always buy the X-Men books
because, right.
you know, Joe Mad was on it, let's say,
or yeah, yeah,
whatever. And I would follow those characters, and, you know, knowing that Nightcrawler was in Excalibur was great, mm-hmm. so I would kind of keep tabs on the side. Mm-hmm. I'd be, like, I had those Marvel cards, and I read the back of them just to see who this person is and what they do.
Right.
But you know, when I jumped on the book, I started doing some research on Excalibur and realized that it was so out there.
Yeah.
The things that they did and the opportunities that is now in front of us to just kind of create within a certain mythology that aren't necessarily governed by the general rules that we know in the Marvel universe, but more of a fantasy based magical world, you know, that was made up. And it's, it kind of gave me a lot of more freedom to just realize, oh, okay. So when we jump to, say, the other world, it could look like this or it could look like that. And I tried to always make the other world a little bit more, while, you know, in the original comics, it was more fantasy, but I thought, well, we're dealing with Arthur and Morgan Le Fay and all these kind of, like, fantasy elements, medieval elements, that I had the chance to really kind of explore a little bit more of a different look when it comes going into those kind of worlds and, you know, just the powers and the different kind of, I would say the different, you know, moods that you would have when switching from scene to scene, so that the reader can at least feel that they're in a different place than the quote unquote real world of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, no, it is. You're right. It's tricky. I remember just recently reading Uncanny X-Force from Rick Remender, and there's that story where they do go into the other world, and that section of the run threw me out of it, but I'm happy I read that story, because when I was reading Excalibur that you were working on, I'm like, oh, now I know what this whole, because I never read Excalibur growing up, because X-Men was so dense as its own little universe within Marvel. There's only, like, you can't read everything, so this is one of my first this is one of my first forays reading, you know, an Excalibur book monthly. And, you know, your art's beautiful. I mean, you're knocking it out of the park. Is there a favorite character that you have to draw? Like, when that person's in a scene, like, it's just the most fun for you?
Well, I'll always have a soft spot for you know, Betsy. Mm-hmm. I really put a lot of time into her looks and how I feel like she would react. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I always try to do, and this is why I always a little longer for have the flavor to say that is noticeable is after 3 issues, because that's when the rest understand the workflow and the characters and on all cylinders at that point. So there's, you know, Betsy, I really like to spend a lot of time thinking about how her reactions, facial expressions, hair, fashion would be like. On the same side, though, too, like Rogue is always super fun to draw. I wanted right. to make sure to bring back her big hair.
Yeah.
You know, like there's a lot of factors into what I like, and you know what, every once in a while it'll change. I always like Gambit too, mm-hmm. but Gambit and Rogue together is always fun to draw because the interaction between the two, you can play around with, you know, different body language techniques and things, and those are the things that kind of tell a story as well.
Yeah, there's a certain, I was going to say strength, but there's a certain charm when you can have these two characters, like when you see Deadpool and Cable on a panel together, there's a certain fun that you can have with those characters. Mm-hmm. It's the same with like Cyclops and Jean or Wolverine, and now with mm-hmm. like you mentioned Rogue and Gambit. Like it's more fun when they're in the same book as opposed to being separated. So I totally get that. Mm-hmm. Before we wrap up, I had a couple of rapid fire questions, this or that, to have a little fun with, to get to know Marcus a little bit more. So is that cool to just sure. keep going for a few more minutes? Okay. So what
is not a problem.
Okay. What is your favorite movie that you could, if it was released in theaters again, you would go and watch it in the theaters?
It's so hard to answer these questions, but I would say there's two movies. I'll give you the one that I love watching no matter what.
Okay.
And then the one that I know is really shitty.
That's okay.
I love Die Hard, so I would watch Die Hard in the theaters.
Great movie.
And I love Street Fighter with Jean-Claude Van Damme, but it's a terrible movie. and I would watch that in the theater.
You and my wife both would be the only people watching Street Fighter because she loves both of those movies, actually. It's funny that you mentioned both of them.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, she loves that Street Fighter movie. What snack would you have at the movie? What would be your snack?
I'm a very standard guy.
Yeah.
a cola, and a bag of popcorn. Like, I'm very traditional when it comes to that snacking.
It sounds like a good movie, a movie day. Die Hard, yeah. Bag of popcorn, and a good cola. Okay. Which album do you feel everybody should listen to?
Oh, man, that's a tough one because I'm not really a music guy that much.
Okay.
I listen to two things, really.
Okay.
So I listen to classical, so either Mozart or Brahms.
Okay.
And that really chills me out. If I really want to get into a groove of drawing or reading a script or something, oh, it's classical. It just settles me in perfectly. Okay. And then if I want to have fun, it's like funk, electronica, synth music, that kind of stuff.
Okay. No, but hey, the classical music, I think it's good for everybody to tune into on that one, especially to be able to chill out and get creative. Absolutely. Do you have a graphic novel or comic book story that never gets old for you? Like just one of those sweet spot stories?
I am a huge fan of, well, there's a bunch, but I'll limit it to three.
Okay.
And they're all Japanese. They're all Japanese. And so Vagabond is one that is just a work of art. It's called Vagabond by Takahiko Inoue, about the story of Miyamoto Musashi. Okay. It's freaking gorgeous. It's a beautiful story and it's just wonderful. The other one is 20th Century Boys, which is I don't even know how to describe it. It's almost the life we live in right now.
Hmm.
Have you ever read 20th Century Boys? It almost feels like. This was not a rapid fire answer, so no, I apologize.
No. It's rapid fire questions. The answers don't have to be rapid fire.
Okay. So basically, it's a story from Naoki Urasawa, and it's about a group of children that grew up together, and then they created this, you know, idea of this almost superhero group, but maybe not superheroes, but hero group. Of themselves, and then they would create like a villain and a problem that this group had to solve. So then it fast forwards to when they're grown up, and the things that they thought up as kids starting to happen in real life, and they have to find out which one of their friends that they knew when they were young that knew the story is the bad guy.
So it's almost like so you're saying with what we're going through now, it's almost like a documentary of the world we're living in today.
Oh, I feel like it is. Because there's stuff with a pandemic, and then there's stuff with like this cult group that ended up taking over the world. It's all over.
I gotta check it out. It's all over the place. It's up my alley.
And the art is beautiful. Art is beautiful. 20th Century Boys. It's about 20 volumes, so at least it's like, you know, like a condensed. It's there's an end. There's a beginning and there's an end.
Okay. And what was your third
one? Third one is more of a fun one. It's Aishul 21. It's one of my favorite sports animes, manga.
Okay.
The art is wonderful. He's the same guy that does the art for One Punch Man.
Okay. Okay.
What's his name again? Yeah, and it's just beautiful art. It kind of became the, well, I feel like it's kind of one of the more early iterations of what is really popular now, and that's the sports manga shonen.
Yeah.
Shonen stories, and it's drawn by Yusuke Murata, which, if he ever did a superhero book, it would blow people's minds. But I'm sure he makes plenty of money on One Punch Man and such. Those are my three picks usually that if anyone ever wants a good story that is I can just tell anybody to read and I think they'd like it, is those ones.
If you were to do a sports comic book, what sport would you choose to tell a story in?
Oh, you know it already, though, right? Like, it's got to be hockey.
Well, it could have been baseball, but yeah, I want to see the Marcus Toll hockey story for sure. And would it end with?
Actually, I'm trying to. It would be 100%. It would be a more of a children's story.
Okay.
Like a Mighty Ducks or the. Okay. So when I was a kid, one of the other books that I read a lot of was this author named Matt Christopher, and he did these.
I think I remember those. I remember.
Yeah,
those.
It's almost like one of those mystery kids books, but with sports.
Yes, I remember those.
Like a Nancy Drew, but they played a sport, and it would be different all the time. And something like that. I would do something like that. Maybe not. But around those kind of age groups. I mean, I'm still trying to. I have an idea cooking, but I haven't broke the story yet. There's so many ideas of revolving around this. I haven't been able to really crack down exactly what I want to do with it yet. So it's in the works, but it's so far from doing it. I might even just do a few short stories of maybe a few characters I haven't decided yet, and just to see what works. I've been reading a lot of random kind of sports books as well.
Okay.
Like actual biographies and different things, just to see if I can, you know, get some ideas of real life things that maybe can be put in a little bit more of a fantastic way, but I haven't gotten there yet.
I'm looking forward to that. That sounds cool. I was going to say, would you make the Canucks win the cup at the end? But I like the Mighty Ducks angle. I like that.
Here's the thing, right? This is funny. So I always joke about separating things in my life, because sometimes you get too attached to stuff, which has happened with me in comics. I haven't been able to read too many comics more recently because I'm just so knee deep into it. It's hard to, have that enjoyment. So I have Star Trek, right? I read the Star Trek books, I watch the shows, but I have nothing to do with Star Trek, very little at least.
Right. That's your escape.
Part of it. Yeah, exactly. That's my escape. And so is hockey, right?
Right.
And even though I would love the Canucks to win the cup one day, if I was to tell a story, I think I would want something more realistic to happen.
Oh, that's funny. It's like high fantasy to make the Toronto Maple Leafs hoist the cup. Yeah, in your dreams.
Yeah.
That was actually going to be one of my last questions in regards to Star Trek, because I heard you're a really big Star Trek fan. So were you?
Yeah.
Do you have a specific universe that is your favorite? Were you an original Star Trek guy, Next Gen? Which one was it for you?
I honestly love them all. I have a soft spot for Voyager for a bunch of reasons. The characters I really like. It came around the time when it was just the right time. My late teens, early 20s. Mm. And Voyager was, one of my favorites because I watched it at the right time to feel it,
mm-hmm.
But I really didn't get into the point of watching everything until I was, 26, 27. Because, when Netflix came about and all this kind of stuff, you can actually sit there and watch it finally, like the whole thing.
Right.
And so when I started watching the whole thing, I realized how good the whole continuity is.
Yeah.
And it made me more and more hungry, which is why I was like, you know what? I need more stories. So I started buying the books and I started reading the books and it's great. It's one of those things where I just can't get enough of. And I think that's the fun part of consuming pop culture and the fact that a lot of your tastes change too, right? Like that's the beauty of what we do is create things for people, but not always the same people. Like things, while generally we like similar things when we were 13, right? There's all this other stuff that maybe you picked up as an adult and you're like, wow, I didn't know if I would like this, but then I really like it now and different things. I think the journey of kind of collecting those and, parts of you that like these things at different points in your life, it's great. I love that kind of timeline and especially talking about it too, because we all have such passion for these things,
mm-hmm.
right? So why not share that passion with everybody?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the reasons I love doing the podcast, because one, I love hearing other podcasts where people talk about things that they like and the impact it has on them. So similarly for this one, like I want to be able to talk to people whose work I enjoy and also share. A lot of times with people who I have on, I just do like, what are your favorite things? Because it's so easy to complain. And there's so much of that already going on that we need more things that people love. So to be a part of that it's important. I think it's very mm-hmm. important.
I agree, and I think people can feed off that positivity too. So
yeah, and you never know where you end up, right? Like these books, especially graphic novels and comic books, because of that combination of the art and the dialogue. You're it's like these little windows of universes that you enter, and you never know what little the bubble, what somebody says mm-hmm. with that picture, that impact that it might have on you. Like I've read some mm-hmm. profound things in a comic book, and it was, for a lot of people, it's the last place you would think that you would find something worthwhile, but there's so much there, and it's important mm-hmm. to share those things with people.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate the time that you gave to today. I really enjoyed talking to you. I could keep going we could keep going. I'd love to, but where can people find?
Well, next time when we'll have a coffee.
Yeah.
We'll have a coffee at the studio next time. We'll continue on the conversation.
Absolutely. Where can people follow you if they want to?
My Instagram is Marcus Anthony Toe, T-O.
Okay.
And my Twitter handle is Marcus Toe, T-O. And yeah, those are the two places, that probably the two best places to find me right now. And if you want to check out, you know, Joyride or any of the Raid anthologies that I have work in, you can go to raid.world. And MarcusToe.com also has a bunch of stuff that you can look at as well.
And Excalibur, we can't forget Excalibur.
Yeah, Excalibur. But I don't sell Excalibur on Raid, so
that's
all right.
That's true.
Go to your local comic store, pick it up.
Yeah, support your local comic shop. You're right. Get Joyride and Raid, the anthologies. Thanks, Marcus. I really appreciate it. Keep up the good work. And hopefully next time we do it, like you said, we could do it over a coffee at the studio.
Sounds good. I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome.